Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. On December 12, 2000, more than a month after the November 7th election, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down their decision in the landmark case of Bush v. Gore. The election was a near draw, and the country was almost equally divided in support for Al Gore and George W. Bush. Any decision by the court would anger half the country. So why did the court take the case? Why did the court get involved in a dispute over Florida state law? And what did Bush v. Gore actually say and do? Did the justices of the Supreme Court really choose our president, or is there more to this story? I have two guests joining me today to help us understand this case and the events leading up to it. Joining me by phone is Ned Foley, the Robert M. Duncan Jones Day Designated Professor in Law at Ohio State University. Professor Foley is the Director of Election Law at Moritz and is one of the nation's preeminent experts on election law. He teaches and writes in all areas of this field. His current research focuses on improving the processes for resolving disputed elections, and he has been asked to lead a new American Law Institute project on election law. Welcome.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be here.
It's very nice to have you. Also joining me by phone is Professor Paul Gurian from the University of Georgia. Dr. Gurian teaches political science, and his research has centered on presidential primaries, campaign strategy, and the Electoral College. He is a prolific writer and has a slew of publications to his credit, and we're happy to have him here. Welcome, Dr. Gurian.
Thank you, Lynn.
Well, this is a case that everybody knows in terms of having heard about it, but I think that there are a lot of issues that perhaps people don't understand. I think there are a lot of things that left people with questions. So I guess where I'd like to start with this is to go back to that November 7th election in 2000 and lay out a timeline. How do we go from voters on November 7th to a Supreme Court decision more than a month later? And I'm going to turn to you, Dr. Foley, for that.
Wow. Well, we could take all day talking about that, and obviously we won't. But I guess one of the important things to realize is that Wednesday morning after the ballots were cast and people realized it was too close to call, you couldn't have predicted that it would have taken the permutations and twists and turns that it did. Because if you remember, the very first thing that people started focusing on was the so-called butterfly ballot. That was the ballot in Palm Beach County where many voters accidentally voted for Pat Buchanan when they thought they were voting for Gore. And it turned out that there wouldn't be a legal remedy for that. And so focus shifted from that to the so-called hanging chads or the dimple chads of the punch card ballots. But in those early first few days, no one really knew what the legal theory would be. They just knew that it was this extraordinarily close election that would be engulfed in sort of multiple controversies before the final focus got all the way to the Supreme Court. So we could go step by step through that process, but there were many different avenues.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to add that there were dozens of cases, the butterfly ballot being only one of them. There were a lot of problems, and some of them worked their way up through the appeals process. Others, like the butterfly ballot, were resolved quickly.
Well, I think that do we want to make a distinction, or do we make a distinction between so-called voter error or voter mistake, whether it's because of the ballot or any other reason, as opposed to where we have a mechanical failure or we have some other kind of problem? I mean, does the court address that people made a mistake, or is that something we're just going to set aside?
I can talk about that.
Yes, please.
Florida law, as established by the Florida Supreme Court quite some time ago, said quite explicitly that voter error does not disqualify a ballot. If the clear intent of the voter can be discerned, then that vote does count. And one of the disputes between the two sides, the Gore side and the Bush side, was what exactly does error in counting the votes mean? And Gore said, if someone makes a mistake, the Florida Supreme Court has said their vote counts if it can be discerned. And the Bush side said, no, they're referring to a mechanical error. That's the only kind of error.
Well, there was really no way to address this issue that people somehow made a mistake on the butterfly ballot and voted for Pat Buchanan by mistake. I mean, there was no way to prove that, was there?
That's correct. In other words, there was a sense that this thing happened. In fact, Pat Buchanan went public and said, I know these people didn't vote for me. But the legal system couldn't handle that because the ballot itself showed a valid vote for Pat Buchanan,
right,
even though that wasn't what was intended. So the Gore legal team quickly said, we can't pursue that as the issue, even if they felt, you know, wronged by it, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
So Paul, let me go back to the timeline here. So we have all of these problems surface almost immediately. I remember the night of the election, mm-hmm. I went to bed, Bush had won. Then in the middle of the night, I got up, Gore had won. At least that's what was being reported. Then in the morning, nobody had won.
Mm-hmm.
But from there, we then go into this sort of legal morass where we have cases being argued in at least two, maybe it was three Florida counties. Talk to us about what happens in Florida before we get to the Supreme Court. And I'm going to turn to you, Paul.
Yes, sure. The networks did call the election for Bush on late in the night of Election Day. And I think that was a mistake on their part because Florida election law says that if any election, if the margin of victory is less than 0.5%, then there must be a machine recount. So they really didn't know who won Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There was indeed a machine recount, and it showed that Bush was ahead, but by a smaller margin. After that, Florida law is election law is kind of convoluted. Just very briefly, what it says is that after the election, any candidate or voter can go to the election board, the canvassing board, in a particular county and ask for a recount. This is called the protest phase. If the recounts are granted, then on a certain date, the Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, would announce the results. Then, it says, it goes into what's called the contest phase, and there a candidate can go to a judge and say, we need to have a recount. And if the judge grants it, then there would be another recount in that county. And here I'm referring to hand recount, not by machine, but by the canvassing board actually examining the ballots.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU, and today we are talking about Bush v. Gore. This is part of our continuing series on landmark legal cases, and joining me today are Professor Ed Foley from Ohio State University Law School and Professor Paul Gurian from the University of Georgia. So let me go back to this. We've got ourselves on the timeline now. We're in the contest phase. What did they have cases in how many counties at the same time?
There were four main lines of pursuit in the Gore team trying to get a manual recount, that is a hand recount of the so-called hanging chads and dimple chads, the ballots that had not been counted by the machine but perhaps were showing a valid vote. Part of the problem, I think, as we look back, you know, with the benefit of hindsight of a decade or so now, is that Florida law was really poorly written, as Paul alluded to. It was poorly written both in terms of the substance of the rules that should apply in a dispute of this nature, and it was poorly written in terms of the scheduling of the timeline in order to complete a recount of a presidential election by certain deadlines that had been set by Congress in federal law. And that's why the whole thing derailed, was because there really wasn't enough time to do the sort of things that needed to be done. And to get to one extra level of complexity on this, a litigation decision on the part of the Gore team magnified the difficulties embedded in Florida law, and it goes back to this distinction between the protest phase and the contest phase that Paul mentioned. At the end of that protest phase, as he said, Secretary of State Harris would issue a certification of the winner. And that was important both as a legal matter, because it established who had the leg up for the subsequent contest, and the opposing person would have the burden of proving that that was wrong, plus a big public relations dimension to who was certified the winner after the protest. So the Gore team said early on, we want to try to win this in the protest. We hope that we don't have to go to the contest. And they were able to persuade the Florida Supreme Court to extend the deadline for the protest, to give them extra time. The protest law as written really didn't give enough time for a hand-by-hand recount of all the ballots in a big urban county like Miami. The other thing that happened was that in the protest phase, after the initial machine recount was done, as Paul mentioned, that was mandatory, it left it discretionary on the part of the counties whether or not they were going to do the full manual recount or not. And so the Gore litigation strategy backfired when Miami County switched its decision and said, after all, we're not going to go through with the recount. So then Gore had successfully gotten the deadline extended in the protest phase, but came up short because there was no recount done in the protest phase, and so then he became the contestant for the second phase.
Mm-hmm. So
yes, I agree with that it was both had legal and political ramifications. And I would just point out that one important aspect that wasn't obvious at the time was that Florida law did not allow Gore to ask for a statewide recount, that he could only ask for a recount in certain counties, and that came up later in the final case.
Well, since we're talking about political issues right here, I mean the fact that the Gore campaign asked for recounts in particular counties ended up being spun on television as picking and choosing.
Mm-hmm.
So, are you saying that by law he had to do it that way?
Yes.
Well, he could have. I mean, yes. He was obligated to go at the county level. Florida had, I can't remember the number of counties, but it was in the around 70 or 80 counties.
67.
So he could have filed 67 different
yes.
petitions. It would have been extraordinarily cumbersome and burdensome, and there wasn't a really easy vehicle to do it. So his point was, hey, you know, I'm not going to do this 67 times. I'll pick the ones that I want to pick, and if Bush wants to pick some of his own, he's welcome to do that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, Professor Foley. Let me ask you about we get these things going. Yes, Florida law was a mess, but generally we let the Florida Supreme Court sort out Florida law. How does the United States Supreme Court get drawn to this, not just in the final decision, but earlier on? How do we get a Florida case in front of the Supreme Court?
Right. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court can only get involved if there is a so-called federal question. And in this case, there were questions of federal constitutional law. Now, early on in the process, most constitutional scholars, frankly, belittled some of the constitutional arguments that the Bush team were advancing in some of the lower courts. They didn't think the U.S. Supreme Court would be interested in them. Turned out the U.S. Supreme Court ended up being very interested in them, and one of them, the so-called equal protection issue, did prevail, which was what gave Bush his victory. And in fact, 7 of the 9 justices ended up, in essence, adopting the Bush position on the equal protection argument. So it was a situation where, public understanding and even academic understanding of the constitutional issues changed rapidly over these, 35 days as the process mm-hmm. unfolded.
Dr. Gurian, you study elections,
mm-hmm.
and in this particular case, Florida's election law, not so good. Of the other 50 states, or the other 49 states, don't we have lots of other states that have the same sorts of problems? Don't we have across the nation where we have within a state, one county counts things one way, another county does things the other way? What was it about Florida that specifically propelled it into a federal question? I mean, don't we have this same sort of equal protection issue out there?
Yes, I don't know the law in all the states, but I know that they vary. The U.S. Constitution says that states can conduct their own elections, and it's common for states to say to each county, you can design your own ballot, you can count it in the way that, that's appropriate to you. So it is common that different counties within different states use different ballots, different recount procedures, and different ways of counting. It has never, to my knowledge, come to a point where one state got so much focus, because as it went, it was very, very close, and whoever won Florida would win the election. And so there was tremendous focus on Florida election law. I don't know if Florida election law is especially worse than most. I know here in Georgia, when they found out that Florida had a 3% error rate, in other words, 3% of the votes were discarded or disqualified, here in Georgia, we realized that we had a 6% error rate. But it wasn't close here in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the reason why so much attention was focused on Florida election law, and in particular, the differences from one county to another. But I think that's common across states.
And I'm going to come back to that a little later on mm-hmm. in our talk, but I want to go now to the main case that went before the court. We have all these legal skirmishes going on in state court, both county courts and the Supreme Court. And then ultimately, we get in front of the United States Supreme Court. And as was pointed out, there has to be a federal question. So, Professor Foley, what was the federal question that put this in front of the nine justices of the Supreme Court?
So the main federal question was the equal protection question. And what the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution does require that states treat people equally in general. I mean, it's a very broad provision. There's no state shall deny any person the equal protection of laws. And in the context of voting, that there since the 1960s, really, there had become a jurisprudence, a body of case law decided by the U.S. Supreme Court that enforced that equality mandate with respect to voting rights. Didn't have a circumstance like this one, but had made sure that there couldn't be poll taxes, so that people had to pay a tax in order to vote. That was thought to be a denial of equality, for example. The claim of inequality was made by then-candidate Bush and his legal team that identical ballots were being treated differently depending upon which locality they were cast in, which whether it was in Palm Beach or Miami or Fort Lauderdale. And even within a particular place like Palm Beach, it would change from day to day as to what rule was being applied. And again, this I've used the phrase hanging chad. If people remember the visual image of some of the officials kind of holding those ballots up to the...
With the punch card ballot.
Yeah, the punch card ballot, and there'd be these little pieces of paper punched out of the ballot. Some of them wouldn't be dislodged completely, and they'd be left hanging, or some of them would have just a little dimple in them. And so the question is, which of the ones that weren't fully dislodged could still... register as an eligible vote.
Because Florida said you look at the intent of the voter.
Correct. And so the Florida had this general standard, do whatever the voter wanted. But how do you specify that with respect to this particular
right.
problem of the incompletely dislodged ballot, chad? And so some counties were more strict and said it has to be hanging in terms of by two corners. If it's
right.
waving, it will count it. But if it's only punctured, doesn't count. Or
right.
some counties said we'll count it if it's punctured, but not if it's just dimpled. So there were these variable substandards, if you will, or implementing standards. And again, in some locations, the substandard changed over time. And so the claim that the Bush team made that was ultimately adopted by seven justices was that variability in local practice treating identical ballots differently, that that was indeed a denial of equal protection.
Yeah, today we are continuing with our series on landmark legal cases, and we're talking about Bush v. Gore. And my guests today are Professor Ned Foley from Ohio State University and Professor Paul Gurian from the University of Georgia. We were talking about the equal protection argument here. And this is an issue that has come up in the past, but I want to turn to you, Professor Gurian. How has this been handled in the past by the federal courts?
Well, I think Dr. Foley can address that better than I.
Okay, Dr. Foley.
Sure. I mean, there's no doubt that this equal protection issue is sort of controversial and unsettled and will need, you know, further development by federal courts in the future. So there is this claim that was agreed upon by seven justices that the different treatment of these equivalent ballots was unconstitutional. There was the counterargument adopted by two justices and many academics that that degree of variability wasn't sufficient to cross constitutional lines, because not every difference of treatment by the government is unconstitutional. I mean, in our first year class in constitutional law, we talk about all the ways the government can treat people differently, from the tax code to the fact that, you know, it's regrettable that blind people can't fly airplanes, but you're not going to let a blind person fly an airplane, but that's differential treatment. And so the question was whether this form of differential treatment is invalid. And some justices said yes, and some said no.
Well, if you look at other decisions, the one that pops to my mind is that this would be similar to Baker v. Carr, where you have the federal government saying, look, you have to have congressional districts, you have to have state districts that are the same size in order to protect the value of each person's vote. Is that the kind of argument that's driving this case, that if you're counting some and not counting others, then we're seeing the value of some people's vote be lost?
Essentially, yes. Yeah, exactly right. That voting is a domain of life where equality is especially important, and you don't want to either deny someone's vote or dilute someone's vote arbitrarily. And there's a sense of arbitrariness embedded in the constitutional jurisprudence, and seven of the justices thought that what Florida had set up and how it was implemented was essentially arbitrary and unjustified.
And I think people are unaware that decision was made 7-2. I mean, there was a very strong agreement on the court that this was a problem, right?
Correct. And there was the sense that Florida could have done a better job, again, with designing its law ahead of time. They could have specified, you know, the two-corner rule or the punctured see the light through the ballot rule. And they had not. They had left it so vague and structurally had given the locality such little direction that was unjustified.
Dr. Gurian, you work, you study and do research on the Electoral College as well. One of the arguments that got put forward here was the so-called Article II argument, which says the Constitution in Article II gives the states the right to choose their own electors. And, of course, what we are voting for when we vote in a presidential race is we're voting for electors to the Electoral College. The argument was, look, Florida can do this any way it wants. It could even not have an election. They could simply just appoint the people to vote on the part of Florida in the Electoral College. Is there validity to that argument?
Yes and no. As I understand the Constitution in that section, and I don't think that's been come up before the courts very often, but the Constitution says that the state legislature can design before the election any kind of procedure that they want. And in the 1800s, early 1800s, it was common that the state legislature would simply appoint the electors. They would write the law that said, after the election, we will appoint the electors. The controversy here, I think, is that Florida law says electors will be appointed according to the results of the election. And the Article II controversy was that it says the state legislature can design the procedure. It doesn't mention the courts, And so the Bush campaign, the Bush lawyers, basically said the courts have no role here. They can't revisit it because it has to be written by the state legislature, and the state legislature is now set to appoint a slate of electors for Bush. Gore came back and said that's after the fact, and just because they didn't say that the judicial branch could be involved, that's the normal procedure. That's what state courts do. They interpret laws written by the legislature. And in Florida in particular, there were a lot of contradictions within the election law.
Okay. Professor Foley, I want to go to you to the remedy issue. What was the remedy? In other words, yes, there's an agreement that the practices are unconstitutional. Now the court has to decide what to do about that. And what's their decision in terms of a remedy for this problem?
Sure. Well, we should start with the baseline. In the normal conventional case, the U.S. Supreme Court, after it pronounces a state practice unconstitutional, says, okay, you can't do that. We're going to send the case back to the state Supreme Court, in this case the Florida Supreme Court, saying don't do something unconstitutional, but you're free to do anything else that you'd like that is constitutional. So it's called remanding the case for further proceedings. And there's a zillion precedents that call for that. So one would have expected ordinarily that's what would have happened in this case. But that's not what happened, and that's what provoked a dissent on the part of four justices, including Clue, who found an equal protection violation. They said, you know, we agree that there was a problem here, but we don't agree with what the majority, five justices, are doing, because they didn't remand in the ordinary way. Instead, they said, we're not going to allow a further recount to proceed. Why not? And this gets slightly complicated. Congress had created something called a safe harbor deadline. Now, what does that mean? It means that if a state were to finish all of its proceedings by a certain date, then Congress would accept as valid the result of those state proceedings. But if they miss that deadline, then Congress would say, well, we can second guess what the state's doing. So it was optional on the part of the state. What the majority opinion, the five justices in Bush versus Gore, said, we have reached the safe harbor deadline. We think Florida wants to take advantage of the safe harbor deadline. Therefore, there can't be any further recounting. The dissenters, the four dissenters, said, well, that's a decision Florida gets to make, precisely because it's discretionary. So the ordinary practice of sending the case back and letting the Florida Supreme Court decide what it wants to do is the appropriate thing to do, and if they think the safe harbor deadline is so important, they'll abide by it. But if they think doing the recount is more important than meeting this safe harbor status, then that's a freedom that they have under state law.
So how did
I would like to reiterate what Dr. Foley said, but put it in a little bit different words. Back in the 1800s, Congress passed the Electoral Count Act, and basically, it says, as Dr. Foley indicated, it basically says that there is a date, a deadline in the Constitution, and in that year it was December 18th, that states have to submit their electoral votes. However, this Electoral Count Act said if a state finishes their count and submits their slate 6 days earlier, December 12th, then they cannot be challenged by Congress. However, if they miss that safe harbor deadline, their votes can still count, and several states that has happened to, their votes can still count, but Congress can challenge. And the way that works is if both houses of Congress agree, then Congress decides which slate of electors actually counts, and if they cannot agree, then it goes back to the executive of the state. And this was really important because it meant that If the U.S. Supreme Court had done the normal thing, if they had said there's an equal protection violation, you can go ahead with your recount, but you must set statewide standards, then your recount would be constitutional.
Okay. Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show. We are talking today with Professor Ned Foley from Ohio State University and Dr. Paul Gurian from the University of Georgia. We're talking about Bush v. Gore. And I want to go back to Professor Dr. Gurian about this safe harbor. In the past, have we ever had any state where their electoral vote has been challenged or electoral choices have been challenged?
Not to my knowledge. There have been states that have passed the safe harbor deadline and there was no challenge. I think in 1960 Hawaii was a month late and their electoral votes were accepted, and I think in 2000 there were several states that missed the safe harbor deadline and were not challenged. So the idea that I think was about what the Electoral Count Act really means, because it had never really kicked in before, and the Bush lawyers said, and the Supreme Court agreed, the Bush lawyers said, the Electoral Count Act requires the state to submit their votes by December 12th, whereas the Gore lawyers said, no, this is only an incentive to do so. You can submit it after the safe harbor deadline. It's just that it could be challenged.
Well, and if Florida would have taken the position, we want to do a recount, and ultimately their votes were challenged, or their electors were challenged, don't we have a constitutional plan B if we don't have one of the two candidates win a true majority? In other words, doesn't the Constitution say, well, if you get a state that's challenged or you get a draw, so to speak, in the Electoral College, I mean, don't we say, well, then you throw it into the House? We have a way to handle this kind of a disruption.
Well, sort of. I mean, this gets very complicated and tricky. But in fact, the sad thing is our Constitution is really not written very well on this to address this situation. The Constitution doesn't contemplate a disputed presidential election. And the reason why we have this statute, the Electoral Count Act, it was adopted in 1887 in the aftermath of our first and really biggest dispute, which was the 1876 election. And what that election revealed was that you could get deadlock in Congress with no constitutional roadmap for an exit strategy. If the Senate wants to do one thing and the House wants to do another thing, and Inauguration Day is approaching, we can get into a constitutional never-never land, which is very scary. And that was actually, people gamed out the scenario in 2000. What would happen if this went all the way to Congress and you had the House of Representatives supporting Bush and the odd thing in the Senate was split at the time with the Vice President of the United States, then Al Gore,
right,
possibly breaking a tie in his own favor.
Right.
So some people think, right or wrong, the Supreme Court at least saved us. The Plan B didn't look so great in some people's eyes.
Well, it seems like Plan B would have been good for Bush. He had won more states. When you go into Plan B, every state gets one vote, which means the fact that he had picked up many of the smaller states would have stood him in good stead. Right?
Right, but that's assuming, and now this gets quite technical, that's assuming that we are in the zone as we were in 1800 and 1824 when it's agreed that no candidate has a majority of electoral votes. There's no doubt that then the House of Representatives, by a special procedure, votes as you said. The really hard problem constitutionally is if there's a disagreement about whether that condition
the triggering condition is
it exists, or instead, does a candidate have a claim to a majority? And Gore, you know, on one theory, had the recount gone forward after a normal remand, and Gore, in fact, won the recount according to the Florida Supreme Court scenario, what might have happened is the Florida legislature on its own initiative would have said, we don't abide by what the Florida Supreme Court has done in its recount, which we don't like. We'll exercise our Article II authority to simply name Bush electors as the appointed electors. Then there would have been basically a competition between what the Florida Supreme Court called for, which would have Gore as the winner, and what the Florida legislature called for, which would have had Bush as the winner. Both of those submissions would have gone to Congress, and then you can decide, you can ask whether the Electoral Count Act gives you an answer as to what to do. Maybe, but what if you've missed the electoral count deadlines? And there, the 6 days between the so-called safe harbor deadline and the absolute deadline become important. Again, very technical stuff. But what if you've gone past both those deadlines and you're into early January, looking at January 20th inauguration? And, you know, one interpretation of the 12th Amendment during the 19th century prevailed. It said that the president of the Senate is the final arbiter. Well, the president of the Senate is the vice president of the United States, and you know, that would have been, you know, and in 1876, it was asserted that the president of the Senate has constitutional authority to, in essence, resolve the dispute and rule from the chair. Again, that's been very controversial and disputed. So the point is, and this is actually an important point for our country going forward, is we think we solved the problem of 2000 by getting rid of the punch card machines. But the truth of the matter is that we haven't. We have an apparatus in place that is inadequate to the task if a similar situation arises. And it won't arise next time over punch cards. It could arise over provisional ballots, or it could arise over absentee ballots, or some other scenario that we haven't thought of. But we are some states are more vulnerable than others. But if we have another presidential election where a single state is the tipping point, could be Colorado, could be Ohio, could be Wisconsin, could be Nevada, but if it all comes down to one state and there's a dispute in that state, we could have a replay of what happened in 2000 just with some little details being different.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU. We're talking about the landmark legal case Bush v. Gore, and my guests are Professor Ned Foley from Ohio State University and Dr. Paul Gurian from the University of Georgia. Dr. Gurian, I want to turn to you. In the wake of this, did other states reevaluate their practices? In other words, once this decision came down and the problems in the Florida election law became clear, did other states move to revamp their own? Did you seek sort of a wholesale change, or at least a wholesale reconsideration of other state laws?
No. So far as I know, they did not. Some states did make some changes. My own state, Georgia, did really react to this and went entirely to statewide touchscreen electronic voting. But as far as I know, most states did little or nothing, including Florida. I believe it was Congress, although I'm not sure, dealt with the problem of provisional ballots. If you show up at the polling place and you think you're registered to vote, is where you voted before, and they say you're not eligible, you can fill out a provisional ballot, and then on the next day or something, someone will figure out whether you really were eligible. If you were, your ballot counts. So this is an improvement, but there hasn't been much done to change the laws.
Today we are talking about Bush v. Gore. This is part of our continuing series on landmark legal cases. And my guests today are Professor Ned Foley from Ohio State University and Dr. Paul Gurian from the University of Georgia. Professor Foley, I want to turn to you. We talked about precedent that the court relied upon in terms of making the decision. But what kind of precedent did this set? In other words, once the court struck down this practice in Florida, how did it affect other states?
Well, that's still an evolving process. People may remember that Minnesota had a disputed U.S. Senate election in 2008, but Al Franken ended up winning that seat. The previous incumbent, Norm Coleman, had been the senator from Minnesota. And that whole case was all about, was this equal protection ruling in Bush versus Gore precedent that would apply to the Franken-Coleman dispute? Again, that the Franken-Coleman didn't involve punch cards and hanging chads, but it did involve differential treatment of absentee ballots. It was documented and agreed by both sides that different localities in the state of Minnesota had, in fact, treated similar absentee ballots differently. So in one locality, it would get counted. In the other locality, it wouldn't. And so the question was, well, was that a constitutional problem just like what happened in Florida, or was it different? The Minnesota Supreme Court said it's different. Why? Minnesota state law had clear standards that were at the appropriate level of specificity, the court said. Therefore, the arbitrariness that it existed in Florida didn't exist in Minnesota. Coleman decided not to take that to federal court, and so that was the first and really most important discussion at the time of how do you apply the Bush versus Gore principle. Along comes a much smaller race in my state of Ohio involving a local judicial election involving so-called provisional ballots, which are a kind of ballot that you cast if there's a question about your status.
Right.
And in fact, the Court of Appeals, Federal Court of Appeals, issued a ruling recently that invoked Bush versus Gore and the concept of equal protection to say that two groups of provisional voters were treated differently, improperly, unconstitutionally, in a way that they should have been the same. Watching that case very closely because it's under the radar screen because it's not a high-stakes race. But the precedent in that Court of Appeals decision, would have huge ramifications in a future presidential election if provisional ballots were at issue.
Generally, if the court strikes down a particular law or particular practice in one state, it applies to all states. Why did the court take this position of limiting their decision just to Florida?
Well, there is this sentence in the majority opinion in Bush versus Gore, which is the most controversial sentence, which essentially says we're deciding only today's case, and we're not extending beyond that. I'm paraphrasing at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and that's been subject to huge controversy and interpretation. Some people have accused the court from being disingenuous in saying that, and was essentially claiming to be lawless and not acting according to the rule of law and admitting it. Other people more charitably have said no, that they were simply in the tradition of the common law judge who takes one case at a time, simply saying we're deciding today, we'll decide tomorrow. It was a very fast-moving decision. The time between oral argument and issuance of the decision was record speed. I think what's most important about that, actually, is that it's not the court that issues the decision which determines its precedential status. It's the subsequent courts that evaluate the precedent. And so even with that sentence in there, it's not the last word. And to me, what's important in watching the Minnesota case unfold and this other case is it's these subsequent courts that are going to actually tell us what Bush versus Gore means and what its implications are, not Bush versus Gore itself.
Dr. Gurian, as you look at this case and the way it was handled by the Supreme Court, do you think, as you look at election law and practice over time, do you think if this were a dispute about a Florida Senate race, and the losing candidate appealed to the Supreme Court, saying there are three counties in this state Senate district, and they're not counting, they're not doing recounts in the same way. Do you think the Supreme Court would have taken that case?
This is very controversial. There are people who who say this was a legitimate federal question and the justices voted according to what they thought was best to avoid a constitutional crisis and so forth. There are other people who say that some of the justices were biased by their own political preferences. And so, you know, if it had been a Senate race, I suspect it would have been less likely to be taken. I'd also like to point out, if it's okay to change the subject a little bit, after the decision was made, a number of newspapers, including New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and several Florida papers, put together a one-year, million-dollar study by a professional organization called the National Opinion Research Center, and they had professional people, trained people, examine every ballot, and the results were interesting. What they found was it really didn't matter how you counted the chads, the hanging chads, the swinging chads, the dimpled chads. Bush stayed ahead no matter how you counted that. But there was one aspect of the recount that no one ever mentioned. Gore never asked for it. Bush never asked for it. And that was a recount of the overvotes, where someone apparently voted for more than one candidate. And what they found was that many people, thousands of people, had voted for their candidate. This is on the kind of ballot where, like an SAT test, where you just fill in the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And they had voted for their candidate, let's say George W. Bush, and then at the bottom it said write in candidate.
Right.
So they did, and they wrote George W. Bush. Now the machine read that as, you have voted for two candidates. Any human being looking at it would say, clearly this is a vote for Bush. So what NORC report said was that if you count the overvotes, then Gore would have won by a very narrow margin, but Gore would have won. And this kind of leads us to a sort of a what-if scenario, part of which Professor Foley mentioned. If the U.S. Supreme Court had sent it back to Florida, said set standard rules, statewide rules, and do your recount, and if they had included overvotes, which the judge in charge said was going to be included, then Gore probably would have won that recount. There would have been a slate for Gore. The Florida state legislature was in the process of naming a slate for Bush. The Electoral Count Act would have kicked in. As Professor Foley mentioned, the House was Republican and likely would have ruled for Bush. The Senate was 50-50. Gore would have broken the tie. And the Electoral Count Act says if the two houses do not agree, then it goes back to the executive of the state, Jeb Bush.
Right. Right. Professor Foley, I want to ask you, if this were a different court, let's say we just go back to the Rehnquist court, do you think they'd come to the same decision?
Yeah, that's also difficult to speculate. I mean, I do think the fact that it was a presidential election gives it a unique dimension that causes you to think about it as a special case. There is, by the way, just on the point about, you know, what is federal law in this area? There was a case in 1994 involving an election to the Alabama Supreme Court. It's an elected office. It didn't get all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but it got again to an appellate level. And it, you know, now with the benefit of hindsight, we can see some of the principles that emerged in Bush versus Gore were sitting there waiting to
right.
be emerged. So, so it's not as aberrational as some people have thought
right.
it would be.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank both of my guests, Professor Foley and Professor Guerian. Thanks for being here. And listeners, I hope you'll join me next week for another edition of The Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU.